distinguished visitor this morning, one of our statewide elected officials. So we'll orient the committee to 3080. We'll ask for testimony from the state treasurer as we go into public hearing and work session, and then we will take the appropriate action.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Randall Edwards, state treasurer of Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to come back before you to talk about another change to the Oregon College Savings Plan, which has been a very successful beginning for the state in helping families save for college. Just simply, this is a bill to allow Oregonians to take all the money that they put into this account from a state perspective and apply it towards college. It would do basically two things. It would remove the state taxes on the earning in the plan, again, allowing Oregonians to use the full amount of money saved from a state's perspective to apply to college educational expenses. And it would also provide us an opportunity to move forward in our marketing plan of allowing us to discuss a tax-free benefit long-term. I've been in the process of working with our congressional delegation. In fact, Senator Wyden has introduced legislation in Washington. I know there's some other bills in Congress to also take the federal taxes off this plan. To remind you how this works currently, it is a tax deferral money put into this plan. As the money grows, it is not taxed until it is taken out, and then it is taxed at a reduced rate, typically for the beneficiary. So therefore, it's a tax deferral, allows the assets to grow more quickly. This bill would simply say that state income taxes on the earnings would not be taxed, and therefore would give that portion of the savings back to the investor and in applying it directly to college. We've had great success already in attracting well over 3,200 investors into this plan. Nearly $8 million have been placed in trust in this, and I feel that this will be an extremely positive step forward in making a good plan a great plan. And again, the underlying goal for all of us in the state is to help Oregonians have an ability to put money aside for educational expenses, and as you all know, that is becoming a growing challenge for many, many families and individuals to reach that dream, and this is one tool to help families throughout the state do that. I'd be happy to answer any questions. This had unanimous support in the House. The chair of the Revenue Committee on the House side put the beginning date, effective date, in for January of 2003, that tax year. And again, I think this is a very good and responsible measure to help Oregonians have an opportunity to save for college and really give them even more bang for their buck as they put into this plan.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. What can you say what the average contribution is? Are they maxing the 2,000 in general?
Yeah. Currently, I think it has been, as just mathematically, as I just described, about $2,000 per individual that's being put in. I think as we go forward and really push on marketing this plan, working with companies, doing some paid media, which we do have a budget for, you will see that number grow. As you recall, there are no limits. Let's just say there's basically no limits per year except for an overall cap per beneficiary of $150,000 you can put away in this plan. The $2,000, as you recall, we have a state tax deduction off your state taxable income of the first $2,000 you put in. That has been a very attractive feature as well. So we know from our experience talking to those who've put money in and anecdotally just personally talking to folks who've come up to me about this, it is the tax benefits that really have been a big incentive to put money aside. And that has been not only our experience, but nationally as other states have a similar plan. That has been a very attractive feature. And the long and the short here is we're trying to create a plan that will not only help our state, but really look at the long term that this will benefit investors and really create a vehicle that will make Oregon a very attractive place for investors.
Other questions from the committee? Mr. Edwards, State Treasurer Edwards, I think we can probably just go to work session on this.
Thank you very much.
Open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 3088 engrossed to the floor with a due pass.
Questions on the motion? The motion is to move the House Bill 3088 IA is engrossed to the floor with a DPS recommendation. Other objections? Hearing and seeing none? So moved. Who would be a good carrier for this?
I'd be happy to carry.
Vice Chair will carry. It's ordered.
Just introduced that legislation in 95.
Really? Got some history.
Mm-hmm.
House Joint Memorial 12 is the next bill up for our consideration. To bring forward our staff person to orient the committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, your name is?
James Jensen.
And Mr. Jensen, you are the staff intern for the revenue staff in the Legislative Revenue Office.
Right.
Welcome this morning. And, please orient the committee to HJM 12.
HJM 12 requests that the Congress of the United States repeal the phone tax. And the federal phone tax is a 3% excise tax on telecommunication services. It was enacted in 1898 in order to help fund the Spanish-American War. It affects taxpayers affects 94% of American households, all the households that have telephones, and generates $5 to $6 billion in annual federal government revenue.
Am I given to understand that we are going to consider removing this great American institution?
I think so.
That's what's proposed by this legislature?
Yes.
I think it's outrageous.
Is this just going to the general fund?
Yeah. It's not not earmarked for any specific purpose. Some phone taxes are earmarked for providing more telecommunications in schools, internet access. This is earmarked just for the general fund in the U.S. Treasury.
I believe that Theodore Roosevelt would roll over in his grave if he were to understand that we were going to repeal the mechanism by which we funded the Spanish-American War. But notwithstanding, you know that there is a member of the Senate who is Theodore Roosevelt's aficionado. I think he's made that known on the floor. If this bill should pass our committee's scrutiny, I have a carrier in mind for this. Well, he's not a sponsor. I think he's very well. Senator Starr.
Comment. I happened to be in Washington about a year ago.
During the Spanish-American War?
No. there was a reenactment in the park in front of the Capitol, and they were debating this very issue a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these troops dressed in the period uniforms marching and making a presentation, a plea to repeal this tax. And I thought, you know, this is very interesting, and why shouldn't we make this happen? And it was just very interesting that I happened to be there at that one day when they were all in dress uniforms and campaigning to repeal this tax. So,
thank you, Senator Starr. I guess the chair's reference to this tax is a great American institution. It refers to the fact that it is a living proof that once enacted, the tax never goes away. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James, I'm kind of curious. When you looked at this, did you find any add-ons in the Vietnam War or World War II?
Senator Beyer, the only thing I found was that it was made permanent in 1990, 3% excise tax. Didn't find any big changes. A couple challenges along the years, but never anything permanent on this.
My memory of the 60s and 70s was that this tax was often railed against because it was one of the primary funding sources for the American participation in the Vietnam War.
Mm. Well, I would say that, Senator, what's begun as a luxury tax has ended up as a nuisance tax. Let's memorialize, shall we? We're in work session on HJM 12.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move HJM 12 to the floor to be passed.
There is a motion on the floor. Is there questions on the motion? Hearing and seeing none, is there objections to the motion? So ordered, Senator Atkinson will carry. We'll end the work session on HJM 12. And I'm betting we're in for a history lesson this week. There's a debate on this bill on the floor. I hope we are. Thank you very much, James. Appreciate the presentation. Expertly done. The next bill is House Bill 2033. We could have the appropriate staff person come forward. Elizabeth Martin Mahar will present an orientation on House Bill 2033.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2033 A and Gross, what you have is a bill dealing with agricultural processing and giving a tax credit for that. And just to give you a little bit of background on this is during the 1999 session, we had Senate Bill 595 that was passed by the legislature, but then it was vetoed by the governor. And what that bill did is it provided a property tax exemption for machinery and equipment used in winemaking for wineries sited on EFU land. And from that bill that passed through the houses and then was vetoed by the governor, this then instigated a interim group during this last session, and it was led by the Department of Revenue, which discussed some of these agricultural processing issues and tax policies. And primarily the interim group focused discussion on the property tax system. And then the Department of Revenue did at that time survey counties to identify some of these agricultural processing property tax accounts and the values of the machinery and equipment and personal property of these agricultural processing accounts. So basically during the interim there was a lot of work done to really bring about this bill and kind of get at what kind of policy should be a good incentives for agricultural processors in the state. Under current law, the machinery and equipment that is used in planting and growing and harvesting are exempt from property taxation. But machinery and equipment that's used after the harvesting operation, that's used in processing then, is valued and it is taxed at this particular time. And so with House Bill 2033A, what it's doing is it's going through and it's establishing an income tax credit or a corporate tax credit if the taxpayer is a corporation, for the machinery and equipment and the personal property. Okay, so there's two different categories, real machinery and equipment as well as personal property that's used in farm processing. Now, there are certain conditions that need to apply, and the reason why these conditions were outlined is because the group felt like it was important to target on-farm processing, target some of the smaller processors in the state. So what the conditions are is that the machinery and equipment must be located on land which is specially assessed for farm use, or it's contiguous to land which is specially assessed for farm use, and it has to be owned and operated by the farm operator. Then that machinery equipment must be used primarily for processing one, and put it in the processing that has to adhere to one of the following conditions. Those two different conditions for the actual farm operation. The farm operator has grown or raised at least one half of the total volume of the farm crops or livestock products that are processed with the machinery and equipment in three of the last previous income tax years. Or the farm operator has grown or raised at least one-tenth of the total volume of the farm crop or livestock products processed with the machinery and equipment for which the credit is claimed in three of the last 5 years. And the farm operator uses the machinery and equipment to process at least one-half of the volume of the farm crop or livestock products grown or raised by the farm operator in three of the last previous income tax years. So the point is, again, to try to get and capture and narrow the number of processors to those who are growing their own crops and processing their own crops. And so then the amount of the credit is computed by multiplying an effective property tax rate, which is something that a farmer could actually calculate and receive himself from his own property tax statement. So he will take the total property taxes divided by the assessed value from his property tax statement, and that will be his effective property tax rate. Then he multiplies that by the adjusted basis of the qualified machinery equipment. And the adjusted basis is something that he will have from a worksheet that he has to prepare each year for his income taxes. So, again, this is a credit that was designed by this interim group in order to be able to allow the farm processor to do this work all himself without having the counties report to them what are the property taxes or what are the property tax rates. The property tax rate and things, the things they can get from their property tax statement. And the adjusted basis is, again, something that the individual farmer will be calculating each year for income tax purposes. So they just multiply that effective property tax rate times the adjusted basis of that qualified machinery equipment. And it may not be all of their machinery and equipment, so they will have to identify which machinery and equipment is used in the processing of certain agricultural products. So this tax credit then is carried forward for 4 years. A tax credit is not allowed if machinery and equipment is fully depreciated for tax purposes. So that's another criteria. We'll be identifying what year this machinery and equipment is in the depreciation schedule and then identifying how much tax credit can be remaining on that particular machinery and equipment. And the tax credit is going to apply for tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2002. So basically with this, there is no local revenue loss, and that was a major part of the discussions during the interim group is to make sure there wasn't, that local governments were held harmless. But what you do see is state revenue impact, and this is on the basis of the amount of tax credit that there will be for these various tax agricultural processors in the state. So the revenue impact is estimated to be a reduction in state general fund revenue of $509,775 in the 2002-03 year and $1.48 million in the 2003-05 biennium.
So obviously from the progression of numbers, we begin this in the second year of the biennium and the result in the general fund is a reduction of $509,000. And the estimated loss in the 2003-05 biennium is $1.48 million. It looks like the credit will go up from about $500,000. It'll grow by about $250,000 in the third year, and then about an equal amount in the fourth year. So there's a bit of an increase process here. That's not a straight line, but a bit of an increase. That as more people know about this, it doesn't just apply to viniculture either. It's any processing.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It applies to a whole variety of ag processing in the state. There's no constraints on that. The constraints are on the processing and the farm operation, meeting those various volume requirements. And just one last point with this, too, is you have the carry forward for 4 years, and that's why you're getting an increase then in the future, because we have made some assumptions about not all of the tax liability being used in the first year.
Sure. Ms. Fraser.
Curiosity question, is there any discussions of how this would apply to packing, meat packing operations, slaughterhouses, or how it applied to the growing nursery business?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Byers, those are processors that are in my database, so yes, they would be able to apply if they meet these volume requirements. I mean, again, you've got just a certain portion of the farm operators that will be able to qualify if they do some processing themselves.
So if Foster Farms were to establish a slaughterhouse and get half of their chickens that they processed on the same site, their equipment manufacturing operation would qualify that?
Ms. Senator Byer, with that scenario, yeah, you just have to think of what, it's just the processing equipment that's going to get the tax credit.
Right.
So it's not any other machinery equipment that would have been used for farming. It's just the processing equipment. And then you have to look at what is the portion that they're processing on their particular site. So, yes, if they're processing and they can meet, 50% of the total livestock that's raised is also processed, then that it would meet the criteria.
The limitation that's coming that would back into this would be limitations in land use that prohibit processing on exclusive farm use designation. In other words, you get fairly tight limitations on what can be done in terms of manufacturing on exclusive farm use land.
Not if it's ag related.
We had a big battle about bottling water in one case, and I'm sure there are some places where we will see
new
expansion proposed
water.
As a result of these
raise it.
Senator Minnis?
I assume this needs to go to Ways and Means.
Senator Minnis, this, like other good bills that we have before the committee, will be heard here in public hearing, not go to work session, be parked until after the revenue projections are released on the 15th, and then probably come in a flurry of excellently considered legislation that will go then to the floor. But Ways and Means chairs will help direct where these tax credits would be approvable. We're basically bringing them over, establishing the substantive hearing to bring them back after the May 15th Revenue Committee meeting. And they would go directly to the floor.
All right. Given that scenario, then, it seems to me that I'd like a little bit more research on who this is supposed to apply to. Okay. It seems to me that it should apply to smaller farms, smaller agricultural interests, rather than large manufacturing companies.
Point well noted. Senator Minnis, I think you'd find that virtually all the wine processors would fall under this. I think probably anybody that's doing a relatively small processing of fruits and vegetables certainly would qualify. But also, you know, if it goes all the way to the scale of commercial slaughterhouse, then we ought to know that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Assuming the revenue impact is...
Excuse me, I interrupted Senator Minnis.
Well, I was just going to say, I'd like to see if we couldn't get committee staff to look at some amendments that would limit it and at some level that would seem appropriate. It seems to me the policy is good if you're really trying to encourage small farms, preserve small farms, and help them become more entrepreneurial. But if they grow to a level that they're very self-sufficient, they're doing well, then I would question whether the tax credit should go.
And Senator Minnis, I see at least two representatives of ag producers or farm organizations, and I would encourage them to talk to Senator Minnis about what applications they see. And Ms. Martin-Mahar, we've had a request for information and a possible preparation of amendments, so I would like to ask you to work with Senator Minnis on that.
Can I just...
Absolutely.
Okay, just Senator Minnis, just to address that issue, just to make sure you're clear, this is just for, you know, land that is specially assessed, so they have to receive that special assessment. So like a lot of large processors would be on industrial land, so that kind of thing does, you know, exclude a lot of the larger processors. And then they, like I was saying, they have to meet these volume requirements, and they have to be, if they are specially on specially assessed land, the only other way that they could qualify is if they were contiguous to the EFU or specially assessed land.
Understand, but in that case, my amendment is